Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, our topic is domestic violence in the economic downturn. Today, Governor Jerry Brown announced another round of proposed cuts to social services in an attempt to close California's estimated $28.5 billion budget deficit. This news, though not unexpected, only adds to the strain that the state's social services programs have faced in recent years. A case in point is the network of agencies that respond to women facing domestic violence. Mounting and sustained economic pressures have seen calls to crisis lines and requests for shelter increase by as much as 50%. And while demand is growing, program funding continues to be stretched. As a result, some agencies have had to reduce services or even turn women away. In turn, scarcer resources mean fewer options for victims of domestic violence, who may be forced to remain longer in an abusive relationship. Tonight, we'll discuss how the economic crisis has affected the victims of domestic violence and those who work with them. What are some of the short-term needs agencies are negotiating in order to continue to provide services? Looking down the road, what are some of the long-term implications of this spike in domestic violence? And how do other factors, like the legal system and immigration enforcement, further constrain a victim's ability to seek and secure help? Joining me in the studio tonight to address these issues and more are Carla Harris. She's the shelter director of the Emergency Shelter Program, a nonprofit agency in Hayward, caring for battered and homeless women and children. In existence for almost 40 years, it's the longest-serving shelter in Alameda County and one of the first shelters for women and children in the Bay Area. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Manoush Kandel. She's a staff attorney at Bay Area Legal Aid, a private nonprofit law office providing free legal services to low-income residents in the Bay Area. Over her 20 years in the field, Ms. Kandel represents abuse survivors and has helped develop policies to improve the response of welfare departments and the San Francisco Housing Authority to abuse survivors. Welcome, Manoush.
Good evening.
And finally, we're joined by Beverly Upton. She's executive director of San Francisco Domestic Violence Consortium and Partners Ending Domestic Abuse, a 17-member consortium of domestic violence organizations and their supporters committed to effective direct services and public policy. Welcome, Beverly.
Thank you, Joseph.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open the phone lines in about 20 minutes, and you can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can send us emails now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Manoush Kandel, I wanted to start with you. Actually, I'm going to ask all three of you this question, but start with you. Tell us, from your experience and from your vantage point, as someone working from the legal aspect of this, how have you seen issues relating to domestic violence and your ability to address these concerns shift over the last several years of this economic crisis that we've been enduring?
I think what's been challenging in the past few years is that while the need for services stays the same or even increases, the resources that are out there are reduced because of a reduction in funding from federal government, state government, private donors. And so when you're working with survivors of domestic violence, you often have less options for them because of the limited resources. So, for example, one of the big needs for abuse survivors, if they're living with their abuser or their abuser knows where they live, is often to find a new place to live. And the lack of affordable housing, the lack of Section 8 vouchers for low-income people who need them is incredibly restricted, and particularly given the cost of housing in the Bay Area for low-income domestic violence survivors, it's really critical to have an adequate supply of affordable housing, and we're just not seeing that right now.
So you're saying that a place to go, a place to get away from the situation, people are finding a harder time securing that and negotiating that.
That's right, because even if they can find a space in a shelter, that's only for 30 or 60 days, and then they need to find a more long-term place to live, and their options are very limited.
And moving to you, Beverly Upton, similar question. What are you seeing as some of the challenges, not only to the survivors of domestic violence, but for you, a long-term advocate for services and policy in this area?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think policy for us is key. Over the last few years, any well-meaning legislation that had dollars attached to it, so expanding services, adding staff, new data processes, gathering statistics, anything with a dollar attached to it was very unlikely to pass. And if it did pass through the legislature, it was very unlikely to be signed. And so I think in the last couple of years, we've seen a real gap in new and improved policies that we could put in place in the state if we had some additional resources.
And can you give us some examples of some key legislation that either never got enacted or at some point got reversed because of funding cuts?
I think most of them really stop when people start to do the analysis and look at when the legislators and the field start to look to see how much it would cost. So say improved batterer's intervention, say we could track recidivism and really track all domestic violence perpetrators and their percentage of recidivism. Well, that costs money. And so while we would love to see more research around batterer's intervention, it's very hard to start these kind of projects either inside the criminal justice system through tracking recidivism or having researchers looking into it more deeply, because the dollars are just not there. And so rarely does it get to committee to actually even be vetted, because in this climate, we've known that most of that legislation is not going to pass. And if it does pass, it hasn't been signed.
And what were the issues that you were most concerned with or and pushing for policy on that perhaps have sort of become put to the side at this point, that are sort of set back at this point because there's just no money or there's less money to fund these issues? So what were the issues even going into it?
Sure. Well,
this period,
what I've already mentioned, tracking recidivism and really looking to see how best batterer's intervention programs and different kinds of interventions can work to change people's behavior. So that would be key, because that would be getting right at the kernel. Right. So that, and then I also think transitional housing, just like Manish had already said, as people are leaving shelter, we want to make sure that there's options, and those options have to be something besides going back to an abusive situation. So we need more transitional programs so women can have, and victims in general and their children can have, long-term solutions on housing.
So what I'm hearing you say or not say is that the immediate crisis response, that not so much of an issue there. It's sort of more of the downstream responses once the emergency shelter time runs out. Those were the areas where you're already pushing for more to be there before this economic downturn started.
Right. I think we're very lucky in the Bay Area. We haven't lost any shelters yet. And our shelters have been stretched very thin, and they're very good at making do with less. And I think that our services at the emergency level have not suffered to the degree that we have seen in perhaps areas where there's only one shelter, or in rural areas where they may be covering 400 or 500 square miles. For example, a shelter in Grass Valley was going to have to close, and Dr. Phil stepped in, right? But we shouldn't have to wait for a Dr. Phil. I mean, that's our safety net for these communities. So, of course, we want to make sure that that stays viable. In the Bay Area, I would say it is viable, but it's very stretched.
And Carla, that's a perfect segue to you, who are sort of on the ground day to day as a director of a shelter in Hayward. How do you see this, the policy stagnation, so to speak, and some of the funding crises that you and your sister agencies have had to contend with? How do you see it affecting the day-to-day operations that you're trying to keep going?
Has already been said, we work with very little resources, and we did suffer some budget cuts. So our staff is working less hours and trying to provide more services. And the frustration is the length of time that the women and children are able to be in the shelter is not long enough for them to gain the resources that are necessary for them to become self-sufficient and independent. The consequences of that are sometimes the women do return to abusive situations because they need to keep a roof over their head. And the other thing that happens is they'll go on to the next shelter for a couple of months. And what we see is shelter hopping, essentially. And with the cut of the transitional housing is a huge issue. It's very disappointing for the women because it takes a lot to leave a situation. It takes an act of courage and blind faith. With very little or no resources. The women and children that we see have no resources. So that's the effects that we're seeing. And, you know, my hope is that more funding will come available for more affordable housing. It just seems like there's a lot of competition for that right now. And they may have a housing lottery where there's 10 slots available, but there's 500 families that need them.
And we keep saying women here, but we're talking women and children, correct?
Yes.
What's the percentage of people, women who come with children when they come to present for services at your shelter? Just a rough estimate.
95%.
Wow.
With young children, preschool age.
Wow. And in order to meet the demand, and have you decrease the amount of time people can actually stay at your shelter, or you had to resort to kind of turning some people away at some point because you were full? How did it work out?
Well,
how's it worked out?
We have turned away a lot of families, and we've learned to work harder and smarter. However, the reality is the resources are still very lacking. So it becomes a difficult choice, and we try to retain these families as long as we can them as much as we can.
On average, how long do women and their children stay at your facility?
On the average, 60 to 90 days.
And you're saying that even that much time doesn't seem to be enough to be able to piece together the next stage?
No, because by the time the women and children come to us, they have been in these traumatic and violent environments for years. So it takes that much time to gain the skills and the resources, 2 to 3 years, realistically.
And what kinds of things are you trying to focus on when you work with these individuals and their children? What kinds of skills, what kinds of resources, just so we have a sense of how little people are coming to you with and how much you're trying to piece together for them?
Emergency food and clothing, just the basic needs within the first week of being at the shelter, and hooking or connecting the women with social services, legal services to get TROs, temporary restraining orders, and then custody issues with the children. And our big focus is then, you know, finding housing and job development, skills development by going back to school, which the enrollment process is a while for a lot of the women.
So it sounds like you're really helping people to reconstruct a life for themselves.
Yes.
I mean, all the things you've mentioned, from the basics like food, clothing, and shelter, to then skills and other resources to be able to turn their life around in the long term.
Yeah, with the goal being not to return back to a bad situation,
right,
or an unhealthy situation.
And going back to you, Manoush Kandel, for a moment, what are some of the key things that when you work with your clients that you're trying to help them navigate? My sense is that in getting out of a situation, there's so much confusion, there's so much uncertainty that and then to have to navigate a legal system and a resources system could be dizzying in the best of times. How do you, when you first meet with someone, how do you try to help them gain their footing in this maze?
Well, our office prioritizes working with people in their family law issues and their immigration issues. And so for a lot of our clients have children as well, and often it's really, really important to help them get safe and secure custody orders in place so that they will not be put at risk and their children will not be put at risk with any, if they do have to have contact with the other parent. If they're married, we try and help them with the divorce. If they want to end the legal relationship, we try and help them get support if there is money on the other side, either for child support or spousal support if they're married. And if there is property, try and help them get what they're entitled to. And mostly what we see ourselves doing is both trying to get them stable, but also trying to give them back their power by giving them a powerful advocate in the legal system so that they don't have to go through it alone, because going to family court can be very overwhelming. And especially they have to see their partner in court, and often the last thing they want to do after they've gotten out of the relationship is see that person again. And so it's empowering for them to have an advocate with them through that process who can help ensure that they're getting what they're entitled to and be their voice in court.
And both to Carla and Manoush, first with you, Carla, what have you seen in terms of the shifts, if any, of the people that are coming to you for services? What are there differences in when they're coming, how they're coming to you in terms of at what stage or with what level of resources or struggles?
You know, it's most everybody that we see have no resources. Mm-hmm. So,
and has that changed, or is that pretty much the way it's always been for your work? I'm trying to get a sense if the economic environment has really impacted.
I think the economic impact is that there's more of a lack of resources to begin with. Mm-hmm. So, and with all of the budget cuts, that's really had a huge effect. And our number of calls has definitely increased. We have a crisis line that, you know, we have someone answer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I've really seen an increase, especially in the last 6 months, and a lot of it is economic reasons.
Hmm. And Manoush, how about you? Who are you seeing, and how's the general feel of the clients you're serving? How's that shifting?
Well, by definition, we only see very low-income people because they have to be very low-income to be eligible for our services. So that hasn't really changed that much. I think what we hear from the courthouse is that there's so many more people who ordinarily would have hired an attorney in the past, but they're not poor enough for our services, but they can't afford an attorney. Mm. And so they're trying to go through this process alone, and it's very difficult.
Mm. And Beverly, it sounds like there's this increase in demand for services at the same time that there's a decrease in the resources. How do you tie together or explain this intersection between the economic crisis and the increased need for services? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a direct link there or not between the economic crisis and domestic violence?
I think there is a link, but I think it's not the most obvious one. I think what we see are survivors staying longer, hoping that things will get better, hoping that somebody's job will stabilize, hoping that their house won't be foreclosed on, hoping, and maybe staying longer than they would.
Why?
Well, I think, you know, if you're trying to rebuild every aspect of your life, and perhaps before you had a job or your partner had a job or you had a home, you had some kind of an asset that you thought you could hang on to as you move through this process, at least there would be something there. But one of our concerns has been that people will stay longer in more dangerous situations because the resources are less. There are a few less options out there, but also just the perception that there are fewer and fewer places to go, which in the Bay Area, we are stretched, but there's still lots and lots of, you know, shelters and legal services and things like that. So we're also really bringing today this message of hope because we are worried that people are staying in these desperate situations longer than they would have in the past.
And what kind of impact do you see that having on people who stay longer?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the points that Carla was making was how little self-esteem and sense of self that people have by the time they reach out for help. And I also think, you know, just the, it takes so much longer to rebuild your life if it's gotten to the point where you absolutely have nothing, no food on the tables, no formula, no diapers, no nothing. Plus, you're just so beaten down that you don't think you'll ever be able to find a job or another relationship or anything. So when, you know, we just are seeing women and their children coming to shelter, especially, but all of these services in really, you know, dire situations. And so, of course, it's going to take just, it takes longer, and it's a steeper climb out towards safety.
Right, and the sort of the reserve and the that people have to work with is already depleted by the time, or even more so than usual, is depleted by the time people come to you. Because my understanding is, you know, oftentimes people who are victims of domestic violence are impoverished in the terms of their resources and their connections, and here you are adding on the economic pressures that are making it even harder, I imagine. I'm going to reintroduce the program at this time in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the economic downturn and its impact on domestic violence with our guests, Carla Harris, Shelter Director of the Emergency Shelter Program in Hayward, Manoush Kandel, Staff Attorney at Bay Area Legal Aid, a nonprofit law office that provides legal services to low-income residents in the Bay Area, and Beverly Upton, Executive Director of San Francisco Domestic Violence Consortium and Partners Ending Domestic Abuse. We invite you, our listeners, to join in with your conversation with your questions and comments. The number to do so is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So to stay with you for a second, Beverly, if people stay longer in these abusive relationships because they just don't have the resources to rebuild their lives, and so they're kind of trying to hope that things may turn around within the relationship they're currently in, do you see, have you seen changes, sort of bad outcomes, so to speak, increase because of this? Increase in violence, increase of the impact of the violence, impact on the children that, that Carla's saying that 95% of her clients come with children?
I think the point about children being exposed to domestic violence is key. The longer people remain in these relationships where there could be domestic violence in the presence of their child, is really endangering their children. Not only could they be injured themselves, but more and more research is saying that, you know, from infanthood on up, witnessing domestic violence and seeing their, generally their mothers being battered in front of them has such a disastrous and long-lasting effect on children. And so we're very concerned about children who are remaining in these homes longer than they have to.
Yeah, Manoush.
And one of the resource problems we're seeing is that one of the social services that has taken a big hit locally is mental health counseling, including counseling for children. And so it's often difficult now to find available services for children who've been exposed to domestic violence, which is what you really want to need if you want to make sure that you're breaking that cycle of violence and trying to help these children heal. Because the good news is they can heal, that children are resilient, and even if they have been exposed to domestic violence, if they get some services and they get some help, they can heal from that. But it's really important that those services be there, and it's becoming harder to find that.
And Carla, how have you seen any shifts in where people are coming from in terms of, because Manoush mentioned something about people who are kind of maybe in between in terms of economic strata and how they're trying to negotiate services. Are you seeing people coming from farther afield or from parts of the county that where you wouldn't have seen them come from before?
Yeah, the big piece is safety, of course, and when fleeing a domestic violence situation, a woman does want to relocate geographically and get as far away as possible. So, of course, we see women coming from other cities or from Oakland and sometimes San Francisco. The other thing that the women tell me is that they can't find affordable housing maybe where they were located before, so they're kind of moving out into the outer areas of the East Bay, where there is more affordable housing. Maybe not necessarily safe. And some of the affordable housing that is in the Bay Area isn't in such safe locations, so we are seeing some differences.
So you're seeing a shift. Are people moving out farther out from the usual centers in order to try and negotiate this concern around housing? It sounds like it.
Yeah, we're seeing that, definitely.
And how about you, Beverly? What's your take on that?
Well, in San Francisco, I think we have some additional challenges in that non-English-speaking communities have a tendency to want to stay culturally close to their community. So while certainly some folks are looking for housing outside, we're also seeing people who really, really, really want to stay with their communities, be it one of the Asian communities or the Spanish-speaking community or many of the other communities that we have represented in San Francisco. So there's a real desire to try to stay in their community if they can. But again, we run into this housing situation, and I'm hoping that we're going to talk a little bit about some of the increased issues around immigration as well. Certainly, that's an issue in San Francisco and the Bay Area and the whole state.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to follow up on the housing piece, but since you brought it up, let's continue with the immigration piece. So help put some of this in context. When we're talking about immigration status, how do domestic violence issues intersect with immigration status? Why don't we start with you, Manoush?
So domestic violence can happen regardless of someone's immigration status, but someone's immigration status can complicate their options. And historically in San Francisco, if someone was undocumented and they were a survivor of domestic violence and they called the police, there really wasn't any risk to them of doing that, which was really great. San Francisco is a sanctuary city and people could rest assured that they could call the police for help and they wouldn't be turned over to immigration. Unfortunately, with changes in the way the federal government immigration service, some new requirements that they've put on local law enforcement and the way it's being interpreted in San Francisco.
Where fingerprints are basically forwarded automatically.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, right now, if somebody is arrested, even before they've been convicted, and many times it turns out that there isn't basis to keep them and they're released, but their fingerprints are being forwarded to immigration, and people who are undocumented are sometimes being picked up by immigration. And so what we're seeing with undocumented domestic violence survivors is sometimes when they call the police and the police come out, the victim is the one who gets arrested, either because she doesn't speak English well and the abusive partner is the one who talks to the police, or maybe in defending herself, she ended up scratching her partner, and so the police come and there's an injury on the person who's really the abuser, and the wrong person gets arrested. And in the past, that could all be sorted out. But now we're seeing sometimes that the survivors are not only arrested, but then are being referred over to immigration and being deported. And that obviously then the word gets out in the community and people become afraid to call the police for help because they don't want to get deported, which is really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And have you heard of cases like this recently because I believe the shift or this new policy has only been in effect for the last several months. I'm sorry, I'm hearing myself again. Sorry, go ahead. The shift in the policy has only happened in the last several months.
I think Beverly is familiar with some of the cases.
We have community meetings with the domestic violence service providers, and we do have now a few examples, but of course we're worried that if we know about one example that there could be tens or hundreds, and there probably could be throughout the state. But we are hearing just the scenario that Manoush outlined, where a survivor, say a Spanish-speaking survivor, could be wrongly arrested for being loud or, really expressing, their emotions. action but may not have been the most aggressive partner and certainly may not be the one who's been having a cycle of domestic violence behavior. So they can be arrested, and in San Francisco and most counties in the Bay Area where we have good relationships with our law enforcement and our district attorney's office, of course they'll revisit the case. But in the meantime, within a very short period of time, I'm hearing, you know, within hours, let's say, those fingerprints and the names can go to INS and so, or ICE. And by the time the DA might make the decision to drop the charges, or the police department may decide not to take it forward to the DA's office, they can already be in a deportation center. So they can already be picked up in San Francisco, and they might be in Marysville or someplace even farther away, which separates them from any legal counsel, any advocates, their children, and their extended family. So it's very serious. And, you know, we're just so concerned about the possible chilling effect in immigrant communities.
So you were mentioning, Beverly, earlier how the economic crisis has constrained people's resources to leave and escape a situation that's been abusive. And now you're adding yet another factor, which is concern about deportation for those who are undocumented.
Yes.
Should they come forward to seek help from law enforcement. This is 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pace, and this is City Visions, and we're talking about domestic violence in the current economic downturn with our guests Carla Harris, Shelter Director of the Emergency Shelter Program in Hayward, Manoush Kandel, Staff Attorney for Bay Area Legal Aid, and Beverly Upton, Executive Director of San Francisco Domestic Violence Consortium and Partners Ending Domestic Abuse. We open the phone lines to you, our listeners, to join us with your thoughts and comments on this issue. The number to call is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So going back to you, Manoush, for a moment on this issue of immigration. My understanding is that it's not all always risky for people to come forward if they're victims of domestic violence to seek help from law enforcement and the legal system around this immigration status. Something about a U visa. Explain that and how women might be able to take advantage of that.
Yes, so one of the really few positive developments we've seen in immigration law in the past decade has been increased options for undocumented domestic violence survivors being able to legalize their status here. And a U visa is a special kind of visa that's available to a victim of a crime who is cooperating with the investigation or prosecution of a crime. And so for domestic violence survivors, if they call the police and they cooperate when the police come out there, they can actually then become eligible for this U visa and have a way to legalize their status here. So assuming that the police don't make a mistake and arrest the wrong person, if they call the police, it can actually, in addition to possibly keeping them safe by getting the abuser away from them, it can also create an avenue for them to get legal status here.
And how often do people know about this and are taking advantage of this?
I think the word is getting out there, but I still think there are a lot of people who don't know. But we have a lot of clients we help. There are several other organizations in the Bay Area that assist with U visa petitions, but there could always be more information out there.
So the key here is that, of course, if you're arrested first and then you're undocumented and your fingerprints get forwarded, then, of course, then you're not entitled to applying for the U visa? Is that how
It's not that simple. If there had been a prior police involvement in the past where the victim had not been, in fact, arrested, it might be possible to start that process after they've been picked up. It becomes much more complicated.
Okay.
In the ideal world, you it's much better if they're not the ones who are being arrested, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they absolutely cannot apply if they've been arrested.
And Carla, going back to you for a moment, what's your sense of how the immigration issues are impacting the kinds of clients that you've been working with even before this economic downturn took effect?
For the women, there's there's part of the cycle of violence is, you know, the threats of being deported by the abuser. And at that level, you know, she won't seek help because she has the fear that she's going to get deported or he's going to, you know, call on her. We do see women at the shelter who are undocumented, who are not aware of the WHO visa, and that's where our case manager starts the process with them. So the word is getting out with the WHO visas. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of women who do not have that information or that knowledge or even a way to get that information. Especially if they're not bilingual or can, you know, if they're monolingual and only speak their own language or their first language, then it's really difficult to get, you know, those kinds of resources.
And Beverly, what do you think is ultimately going to be the solution around this issue in terms of from an advocacy standpoint? It sounds like on one level there's the U visa, but on the other level there's the it's sort of like a schizophrenic approach, right? That women who come forward and might be arrested in the process put themselves at risk. So what's the advocacy strategy on this issue?
Well, I think having a strong advocate in along with them in every step of the system, be it the legal system, the immigration system, if it's the criminal justice system, the child welfare system. But also, you know, we're really working towards having dominant aggressor trainings with all police forces and district attorneys. And so that should help mitigate some of the wrongful arrests that we're seeing.
What does that mean?
That would be a training where the community and police officers or DAs could work together to look at how to better assess a situation to see who is a dominant aggressor, where the cycle of violence has been happening for a long time, who's been the aggressor long term, and so that everything doesn't look like a one-time situation and that, you know, one person might be going to jail after they've been the victim for 20 years.
Because at one point, or in the moment when the police became involved, they were trying to defend themselves, and it looked like they were the main perpetrator.
Right. And certainly that's not the case all the time, and we're not here to advocate for anybody being violent, but we do think certainly there's an opportunity to refine our techniques, and there are new best practices out there, and we're hoping that state, federal, and local law enforcement and criminal justice will partner with the communities to try to make this a better situation.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com to join our conversation tonight about domestic violence and the economic downturn with our guests Carla Harris, Beverly Upton, and Manoush Kandel. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. So I wanted to shift the conversation now to talk about the housing issue, because I know it's something that each of you have mentioned in turn and seems to be a pretty critical piece in helping people get themselves and their lives back together. So Manoush, give us a sense of what are people contending with when it comes to trying to negotiate affordable housing and how the economic downturn has just made that even harder?
Oh, well, it's just there's not enough affordable housing.
Is it that simple?
That it's basically that simple. It's basically that simple, and that it's been made worse by years of the federal government not providing enough funding for public housing and Section 8 vouchers, and then local and state not being able to pick up the slack recently with the economic downturn. But I do want to say, with all the gloom and doom, that there actually is one ray of sunshine in terms of a new state law that went into effect in January of this year that created some new protections for domestic violence survivors who might want to stay in their home. That's important for people to know about. So I'd like to talk about
that.
So this is a state law that does a few things. One is it allows people who need to break a lease, who ordinarily wouldn't be able to because they still have, you know, a certain number of months left in their contract, to be able to get out of that lease if the reason they need to break it is because of domestic violence. So that enables someone to not have to keep paying in a unit that's not safe for them, but enables them to give the landlord 30 days notice and then be able to get out of that lease and find a new place to live.
And what's the burden of proof or documentation that is required under that law?
So under the state law, the survivor of domestic violence or sexual assault or stalking has to have either a police report or a restraining order from within the last 60 days.
Not that much, that sounds like to me. That's a pretty low barrier, you'd think?
I mean, not everybody calls the police and not everybody wants to get a restraining order, but it's certainly a big improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't help everybody, but it will help a fair number of people.
Okay, and this would also, I imagine, then decrease the likelihood that someone would be evicted and then have an eviction on their record, and when they're trying to secure housing in the future, may make it more difficult, right?
Right, they shouldn't, right, exactly. If they leave and they can't pay the rent and their landlord is keeping them into this lease, it's a problem. So this solves that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of that bill is that it requires landlords to change a lock within 24 hours if somebody shows them that there's been an incident of domestic violence, either through a police report or restraining order. So that's really important if they want to stay where they're living, but change the lock so their abuser can't get back in. They can do that. And then also there's new eviction protection in that. Sometimes what we see is if somebody is a victim of an incident of domestic violence, the landlord will try and evict them, saying that they have created a public nuisance in their unit, even though they're the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And this new law protects them and doesn't allow a tenant to be evicted for acts of domestic violence against themselves. Again, they have to have a temporary restraining order or a police report issued within the last 180 days.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a significant new protection under state law. San Francisco already had an even more generous law, but this now applies throughout the state.
I see. And I wonder how many people who are victims of domestic violence and or landlords are aware of this new state law, and where can people find information about it? So in case someone has to kind of present this to their landlord, or for landlords who want to get more information,
right,
and educate themselves.
It is a brand new law. It went into effect January 1st of this year. The bill is SB 782.
SB 782.
Yes. So they can get a copy off of the state legislature website and read it. If people have questions about how it applies to their own tenancy, they can call our office for legal advice.
This is the Bay Area Legal Aid.
This is Bay Area Legal Aid, and our number is 800-551-5554. That's 800-551-5554.
And what we'll do is we'll have you repeat that at the end of the program, and we'll make sure to put a link to your information and others here on our website, which is cityvisionsradio.com. So to stay with you just for a moment, any other things, any other positive developments or any other difficulties in navigating the housing issue?
I think there's a big barrier sometimes for people in public housing who are extremely low income, often rely on the public housing authority to provide them with housing. And when they need to move, there's often a problem with the housing authority not having adequate places to move them to, or even if they do, not moving them properly. And so we do a lot of work with the San Francisco Housing Authority to improve how they respond to domestic violence survivors, but we still see sometimes that it's very problematic for people who need to move and live in public housing.
Mm. Beverly, anything you wanted to add?
I just think that we're very proud of this legislation. Supervisor Carmen Chu authored it in San Francisco. I think we really helped refine it, and then Leland Yee picked it up and brought it to the state level, and we're just really excited. We think it's a huge tool and should help people stay in their homes and not perhaps have to go into shelter, especially if there's been some kind of separation where they can stay in their homes. This should really help them. Or the flip side of the legislation is if they need to leave, they can. So it also frees survivors and their children up to make a new start without that daunting, 8 or 10 months of rent that they might have been held responsible for in the past.
Okay, 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to Faith from Palo Alto. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
I served on a jury in a domestic violence case, and one of the things that was extremely distressing to me was to find out that once you were on a jury, you were not allowed to do any research in re- regards to either the jury process or the incident, of course, that was being treated. But I would really like to encourage your listeners to find out what your rights and obligations are as jurors before you get in a position of being called to a jury. And in our case, there were people on a jury who actually said things like, I'm not saying she got what she deserved, but you have to admit she was asking for it. And this was a Palo Alto jury with Stanford professors, highly educated people, and I was shocked to the bone to find out how much prejudice and discrimination there was. It was deeply disturbing. And you know, I've heard about this, but I've never witnessed it. And it was one of the issues that came up was in terms of the man who did the beating, theoretically protecting his child from this woman who was portrayed as being somewhat crazed. But, you know, a lot of women get portrayed as crazed in a lot of situations. And so I just think people should find out about how to be on a jury before they get in that position.
And given your experience, what would you do next time around if you're on a jury, whether it's related to domestic violence or another kind of case?
I think I would do a lot of formation of my ideas on paper to address people on the jury. It's very hard to think on your feet in that situation. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of anger. There's, you know, I mean, I don't know other people's jury experiences, but I found it difficult to voice and make my thoughts coherent under that circumstance. And, you know, to simply be able to put things down and ask and remember that you have the right to demand of your other jurors that they justify their speech and their actions and their decisions. Because if you don't have a good, I forget what the name of the person has the jury is, but
the foreman or foreperson.
Thank you, the foreperson. If they're not organized in it, you know, they're doing things like having you take a vote before you've even discussed the issue, which starts to lock people into positions and they get defensive. Anyway, I think there are a lot of ways to approach it. But
well, thank you so much, Faith, for your call.
Yes, thank you for taking it.
Beverly?
I think we've been so lucky to see both district attorneys and defense attorneys really raise awareness of juries as they're presenting a case. It doesn't sound like it happened in this case, but it is, I think, so key in raising the awareness of people who sit on juries and are out in the public around what the real dynamics of domestic violence are. And I have to say that I'll just speak for San Francisco. Most of the cases that we see, our DAs and public defenders and private defense attorneys really do their best to try to raise the awareness of the jury. They bring in expert witnesses. They talk about the dynamics of domestic violence and try to kind of dispel these myths before and during the case, before it gets started. So I'm hoping we're headed in that direction. Mm. And this is disturbing to hear, but not surprising.
Mm-hmm. And Manoush, did you want to add to that?
No.
Being in the court yourself?
Yeah. Well, we don't have juries in family law cases, but I just think Faith reminds us that there's still so many stereotypes and misconceptions about survivors of domestic violence out there. And so we still have a lot of work to do to
teach people. Like it. And I imagine, Carla, with what you were saying earlier about how many of the women who come to seek your services are sort of broken down in terms of their self-esteem and their sense of self-efficacy, that some of these myths then, of course, make it even harder for them to come forward and then to advocate for themselves once they do.
It does. And we spend a lot of time trying to assist the women with building their self-esteem and also knowing that no one deserves to be treated like that, regardless.
415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to Susan from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks a lot for doing this. It's a great program. Back to the conversation about law enforcement outreach to immigrant domestic violence survivors and the issue of immigration consequences from contact with law enforcement. I've done trainings for law enforcement in Alameda County and found that the police are appalled when they hear about cases where Immigration and Customs Enforcement puts a hold on somebody because they were wrongfully arrested. And you can see that it hits them hard, and they think, you know, this is something that we have to guard against with everything in us. I've just been amazed by how seriously they take it. And I think that it's part of, because, and Beverly earlier said that, you know, we've been really lucky with district attorneys and people. It's actually because of the work of the, you know, the people on your panel, that because so much great advocacy has been done for the last 30 years, that law enforcement is much better in this area than it is in many places of the country, because people just keep at it and keep training and keep advocating and keep doing programs like this. So thanks.
Thank you so much for your call, Susan. So in the last sort of 10 minutes of the program, I wanted to take a sort of a long view, looking forward, thinking about how the current economic climate sort of setting back the advocacy movement, and we talked about how it set back some of the resources, but how is it setting back the advocacy movement, and what are going to be some of the long-term implications of this period of time on those currently who are contending with domestic violence, and in general, the entire system that's trying to serve them. Let's start with you, Beverly. I know it's kind of a tall order to look forward like that, but
it's a very broad subject. I will also start my comments by saying we have been successful in San Francisco. That while we have had proposed budget cuts every year for the last 3 or 4 years, by the time the community meets with the mayor, meets with the Board of Supervisors, and meets with policymakers, both at the local level in San Francisco, and we'll talk a little bit more about the state level, we have been able to have those cuts reinstated by and large. Certainly there have been federal cuts that have come down and state cuts, but in some ways it has helped us organize to be stronger than ever. And I think almost back to what Faith was talking about, I think it helps us raise awareness, and what Susan was talking about, helps us raise awareness with lawmakers and city government, and we'll talk about state government as well. But when the impact is really presented and presented in a way that talks about both the human toll and the toll on city services, if somebody doesn't go to shelter and they end up in the emergency room, or, you know, worse, what those dollars look like, our city has gone ahead and kept that safety net intact. It takes a lot of our capacity to do it. So, of course, we'd like to know that, you know, we have that ongoing support. But I think as we are in a shift in leadership and a transition period, we're hoping that we will see that again. But at the end of the day, San Francisco has chosen to keep its violence against women programs intact.
And Carla, how are people responding in the East Bay and Alameda County specifically, both on the advocacy level and the service provider level?
We just recently joined another collaborative coalition to share resources, share information, and I think that even though we are in an economic crisis, like Beverly was saying, it's made us be stronger and more united as advocates for women and children.
And Manoush, as you look forward in terms of the legal climate around this, what do you see as either setbacks or shifts that have occurred that are going to need some time to correct over time, or if not, if there are no issues in that area, what are some of the legal frontiers that you'd like to see pushed on?
Well, I want to echo what Beverly said about doing more training with law enforcement on dominant aggressor, because we are still seeing too many survivors of domestic violence being arrested, both immigrant women and non-immigrant women being arrested when they're really the victim. So I think there's room for more training and improved law enforcement response. I agree with Susan that law enforcement has done a great job and has improved a lot over the past 30 years, but there's still some room for improvement. But I also want to make sure people know that even though resources are stretched, there's still help out there. There's still hope. I want to give out some hotline numbers before
Absolutely.
We end, so that people, if they're listening and they need some help, or they have a friend who needs help, they know where they can call. So in San Francisco, the Woman Inc. 24-hour crisis line number is 415-864-4722. That's 864-4722, and they're 24 hours a day. And then there's a national domestic violence hotline that people can call anywhere in the country to get help, and that number is 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. So I want to make sure people know that there is still help out there, and they shouldn't give up just because things might be a little bit more difficult in terms of resources.
Mm. And we'll again put links to those websites or those services on our website, cityvisionsradio.com. And Beverly Upton, back to you again. So you're saying women are concerned because of their current economic situation and delaying. What kinds of words of encouragement would you give to someone who's considering making a move but perhaps feels a bit trapped right now because of limited resources?
Mm-hmm. Reach out, pick up the phone, talk to a friend, talk to an advocate. We are there. All of the Bay Area counties still have very good domestic violence services. We can help. You are not in this alone. And I'll add another piece of hopeful news to what Manoush just mentioned. When we talk about the budget cuts that we've experienced in the past, I think everybody knows our former governor chose to veto all domestic violence funding for 2 years in a row. It was indeed reinstated last year at its normal level. And the new budget just came out from our new governor, Jerry Brown, today, and domestic violence shelters are included in that budget. So things are looking better and more hopeful.
That's great.
Yes.
And Carla, to you, if you could get the ear of some funder or some legislator out there for just, 30 seconds, what would be the top things? You mentioned housing already, but what anything else that you'd be asking for to help the women that you serve?
Education.
Say
education
more.
And training. I think it's really important, looking at the cost of living in the Bay Area, to consider careers and funding for these women to get into careers that they can actually support themselves and their children at a very comfortable level.
Mm. And that right now, that's still something that's difficult.
It is.
Yeah. And Beverly, for the children that we really haven't talked about a lot tonight, what sort of priority there would you like to see addressed?
Well, I think we have some programs that help address the damage done by children exposed to domestic violence. Certainly in San Francisco, we have the Safe Start program that is hosted by the Child Abuse Prevention Center. That can be reached at their hotline, 444-441-KIDS. I hope you're going to put a link to that. I think you might. We also have a project here in San Francisco in collaboration with San Francisco General Hospital called the Child Trauma Project. It works with children 0 to 3 that have experienced domestic violence and really helps rebuild that bond and heal that bond between the mother and the child. So we're both very excited about both of those projects. I think, further work can be done in the schools. We have a lot of work around the LGBT youth community. Mm-hmm. We have so much work to do. And if we have the support of legislators, our government, I think we can do that.
Sounds like it takes everyone and a village in all parts of society really to address this large-scale issue. And that's all the time we have for tonight. That's City Visions. Our guests tonight were Carla Harris, Shelter Director of the Emergency Shelter Program in Hayward, Manoush Kandel, Staff Attorney at Bay Area Legal Aid, and Beverly Upton, Executive Director of San Francisco Domestic Violence Consortium and Partners Ending Domestic Abuse. Thanks all three of you for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows and to the resources we talked about, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, join our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineers this evening were Alan Farley and Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. City Vision senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Freese manages our website. We'll be away next Monday for the MLK holiday. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer in 2 weeks. This is Joyce Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.